Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel 14. I'm going to do half of the book, verses 1 through 23, and I will entitle this section, Jonathan Defeats the Philistines at Michmash. Our context is this. In chapter 13, we see Saul positioning his troops as he's getting ready to face the Philistines at Michmash. And so we begin now in 1 Samuel chapter 14, except we're going to really take the last verse of 1 Samuel 13 to give some context here. So let me read that, 1 Samuel 13:23. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass at Michmash. Now, a look at the map here tells what the situation is. Saul had sent 1,000 soldiers out in chapter 13, 1,000 to Michmash, 1,000 at Gibeah, which is just to the southwest, about 5 miles. And he also sent to the southwest of Michmash, and he also sent out 1,000 troops, or he split 2,000 troops between Bethel and Michmash, probably 1,000 at Bethel and 1,000 at Michmash. So we see the garrisons of the Hebrews spread right around the heartland there of the tribe of Benjamin. Now, we don't know whether these troops stayed there during this battle in chapter 14. We don't know. They might have melted into the hills and hid in the holes and the caverns and the cisterns and the caves because they were so afraid of the Philistines. In our last chapter, we see that Jonathan took his contingents from Gibeah and went up to Geba, which is just on the southern side of the valley that separates Geba and Michmash. There's another place called Migron, which we'll talk about in a minute, which is somewhere, it's a question mark on the BibleAtlas.org map, somewhere on the outside of Michmash. The map has it right to the north and west of Michmash, on the northern side of the valley that separates Geba and Michmash. So 1 Samuel 13:23 says, and the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. The pass is probably that valley that runs between Michmash and Geba. And remember, Jonathan is now stationed to the south of Michmash on the southern side of that valley. So he could look across from the hill of Geba. Geba means hill. And he could look across that pass there, that valley there, and see Michmash. And the Philistines are there. So now that we've set the stage, let's start with verse 1 of 1 Samuel 14. Now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, come and let us cross over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. That's the other side of that valley there that runs between Geba and Michmash. He wants to go down in the valley, back up the hill, to go to Michmash. And of course, it was a fortified position. At the top of a hill is hard to take. But he did not tell his father, the text continues in verse 1, Jonathan did not tell his father Saul what he was doing. Now it says in verse 1, now the day came that Jonathan, that does not necessarily mean that Jonathan's foray up to Michmash took place in the daytime. It could have been just the time. Now the time came that Jonathan went up there. In fact, it probably makes more sense that it was done at night, maybe. But on the other hand, it could have been done in the daytime too, so we're not going to worry about that too much. Now, why did Jonathan not tell his father Saul about what Jonathan was planning to do? Probably because Saul might disapprove of his action and hinder him from going, because it was a pretty gutsy thing he did. He took himself and his armor bearer to attack the whole Philistine camp. This, of course, brings up a preaching point here, an application point. How many times are the people of God outnumbered? How many times does the battle look hopeless? How many times does a minority win the battle? Think of Gideon, recall that. And now here, this is another classic example, because Jonathan's going to win this one. Now, Jonathan going up to Michmash from Geba without telling his father Saul might have been a breach of military discipline. He engaged in an attack without the knowledge of his commanding general. But it could be that Saul had given standing orders to Jonathan to attack when ready, to attack when the situation was propitious. It could be, so we can't prove that Benjamin was being that Jonathan was being rebellious here. John Gill says Jonathan attacked because he was stirred by the Spirit of the Lord. We go now to 1 Samuel 14:2. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people who were with him were about 600 men. Now Migron is right on the outskirts of Michmash. The outskirts of Gibeah sounds a little bit stretched because Gibeah is about 5 miles southwest of Michmash. But I guess it's close enough where you could say it's on the outskirts of Gibeah. So I'm taking BibleAtlas.org's speculation for it. They got a question mark by it, but they've got it right close to Michmash. That's where Saul was. Must have been a very prominent pomegranate tree to call it the pomegranate tree. Now, Saul only has with him about 600 men. These he had brought up from Gilgal, where the campaign against Michmash originated, as we saw in the last chapter. Now, these numbers that were previously dispatched from Gilgal in the last chapter, 1,000 at Gibeah, 1,000 at Bethel, 1,000 at Michmash, I think aren't applicable anymore. I think most of them melted away and were hiding in the caves and the holes. And so Saul's only got 600 people now because people are scared. Now, that 1,000 at Bethel, 1,000 at Michmash, 1,000 at Gibeah were those that were sent out in advance, kind of like garrison duty. But now Saul had come up from Gilgal in the last chapter, 1 Samuel 13:15, and he'd carried 600 men with him. These are different 600 men. So let me read that, 1 Samuel 13:15. Then Samuel went from Gilgal to Gibeah in Benjamin. Saul registered the troops who were with him, about 600 men. Then Samuel went from Gilgal to Gibeah and Benjamin. Saul registered the troops who were with him, about 600 men. So Samuel goes to Gibeah. Saul goes to Michmash with 600 measly soldiers. We continue now in 1 Samuel 14:3. And Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord at Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. People did not know that Jonathan had gone from where? From Geba, which is south of the valley that runs south of Michmash. Now, in the middle of this battle, all of a sudden we hear about somebody wearing an ephod. Now, what's the big deal about that? That does seem somewhat out of place. Well, before we get into that, let's see who we're talking about here that's wearing this ephod. We go back to the times of Eli at Shiloh. That's the first part of the 11th century B.C. We're down there at the bottom part of the 11th century B.C., say 50 years or so. And if you recall the story, at Shiloh, Eli was ministering. His sons were reprobates. They were stealing the offerings that belonged to God. They were sleeping with women at the door of the temple. They got involved in a war with the Philistines. They went west of Shiloh about 20 miles to a place called Aphek. The Philistines were at Aphek, and they were at a place that was 20 years later called Ebenezer. They had a battle, and they lost the ark. Well, as the two sons of Eli, the reprobate sons of Eli, came back, they were named Hophni and Phinehas. One of them, Phinehas, had a wife who was with child, and apparently the shock of the battle caused her to go into premature labor. She has a child. Her attendants say, "Woo, you've got a son. Isn't that wonderful?" And she says, "No, it's not wonderful." She names him Ichabod, which means the glory has left, i.e. the glory has left Israel, and then she dies. All right, well, that wife that had Ichabod was married to Phinehas. This is not the famous Phinehas of the zeal of Phinehas, which happened about 350, 400 years ago on the plains of Moab. Now, this is the Phinehas, the son of Eli. So this woman, unnamed, has this baby named Ichabod. Well, Ichabod had a brother. Ichabod, the glory has left Israel, had a brother. The brother was named Ahitub. And Ahitub had a son called Ahijah. Now, that's about 50 years worth of genealogy to get us down to the time of Saul. This Ahijah is, most people say, also the same as Ahimelech. This is the famous Ahimelech who was murdered by Doeg, the Edomite, by the direction of Saul with the priest at Nob, or Nob. Let's call it Nob. 1 Samuel 22:9. Then Doeg the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, said, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub." See, Ahimelech the son of Ahitub, Ahijah the son of Ahitub. So most people put them together. But the Cambridge commentator says that they might be separate people. It is also possible that Ahimelech was the brother of Ahijah and his successor in the high priesthood. But anyway, the genealogy is not what the author is focusing on here. The focus is on his fact he's wearing an ephod. Now, of course, an ephod is a breast piece that goes on top of the linen tunic of a high priest. So an ephod is what a high priest wore, not a common priest. Well, so what? So apparently Ahijah is now performing the role of high priest. Well, so what? Well, the ephod had within it the Urim and Thummim. Nobody knows exactly what that is. I always like to think of it a white stone, black stone. You pick the white stone, that's yes. You pick the black stone, that's no. You ask questions of it, and you get yes, no answers, and that tells you what to do. This, of course, was sanctioned by God, and it's mentioned here to show that the high priest was now with Saul. and to show that Saul wanted to inquire of the high priest by using the Urim and Thummim. We read in verse 37 of this chapter, 1 Samuel 14, Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him on that day. And how do you inquire of God? You ask of the Urim and Thummim, which were in the ephod, and the ephod was being worn by Ahijah, and that's why it's mentioned here. We'll see most of the ramifications of this in our next audio in the second half of chapter 14. Now, the ephod, the high priest, is with Saul, and some say it wasn't only the high priest that was with Saul here in this battle, here at Migron on the other side of Michmash. Some say the ark itself was there. In verse 18 of this chapter, we read, Saul told Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God, for it was with the Israelites at this time." Now, the last time we saw the ark, it was a little bit west in the city of Kiriath-Yearim, where the Philistines had left the ark. Well, actually, the Philistines had left the ark at Beth Shemesh, a little bit to the southwest, and the Israelites at Beth Shemesh, because they looked into the ark and died, said, "We don't want this anymore." They sent it up to Kiriath-Yearim, and that's the last we've seen of it. And now, apparently, the ark is brought to Migron here with Saul. However, there is a translation issue, which I will talk about in a minute, and it could be that Saul told Ahijah, "Bring the ephod of God." We'll look at that in a minute, so that's not clear. But we do know that the ephod's there, and we know the high priest is there. Saul's got some religious backing in this battle. It doesn't appear that Ahijah with Saul when Saul offered his sacrifices. Normally it's high priest that offers sacrifices. 1 Samuel 13:9, the last chapter. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings." That was at Gilgal. And he, that was Saul, offered the burnt offering. At least Saul had the burnt offering offered, and it doesn't appear that Ahijah was there. And remember, Samuel wasn't too happy with Saul, and many people think it was because of this stepping into the priestly role. Well, that's not going to be the case here. There is a priest with Saul. The last part of verse 3 says, "And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. He had left Geba with his armor-bearer to cross the valley, to go up into Michmash and to attack the Philistines." Now, Jonathan originally had 1,000 men with him, as I said earlier. That was in 1 Samuel 13:2. Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel for himself. 2,000 were with Saul at Michmash and in Bethel's hill country, and 1,000 were in Gibeah of Benjamin. But we don't know whether those garrison troops are still there as we go from chapter 13 to chapter 14. Some people speculate they probably had left already, and we know for sure that Saul only had 600 as he came up from Gilgal, and it's not likely Jonathan would have more troops at his command than his boss, his commander, his commanding general, who only had 600. So we'll leave the numbers in the air in the realm of the unknowable. We'll accept that we know that Saul had 600 and Jonathan didn't have too many, probably, as he gets ready to attack. We know that he attacked only with himself and his armor-bearer. We go down to 1 Samuel 14, verses 4 through 5. "There were sharp columns of rock on both sides of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine garrison. One was named Bozez and the other Sina. One stood to the north in front of Michmash and the other to the south in front of Geba." Now, the pass that's being crossed here by Jonathan is probably a pass that went from the northeast to the southwest, all the way down at Gibeah, all the way up to Michmash. Or it could just be the pass that runs between Geba and Michmash, that valley I've been talking about. That's the easiest way to look at it. Because verse 5 says, "One of these crags of rock stood to the north in front of, or beside Michmash, and one to the south in front of Geba," which means the pass would run between them. And so they have to cross the pass. And when I say north and south, the crags are north and south, but in such a way that in order to cross between them, you have to cross between them in order to get up to Michmash. I can see it in my head. I can't describe it too well since you don't have a map, but that's basically what's happening here. And Jonathan and his armor have got to cross that pass to get to the Philistine garrison at Michmash. Now, the names of the crags were named. I don't know why. Bozez on the left was named Lubrication, because the rock must have been smooth and slippery. Sina, the word means treading, trodden down and beaten. Little detail that I don't know what importance it is, but we do know that Bozez and Sina were sharp columns of rock, as the Holman Christian Study Bible puts it. The NASB has crags of rock. And we do know that after Jonathan and his armor bearer crossed that pass there, the valley, they had to go up one of those crags. apparently, because later on we'll see them climbing, if they'd have gone right down in the pass, they would have been spotted very easily. But once they got to the crag, they would have to climb over it in order to get to the garrison at Michmash. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verses 6 through 10. Then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." His armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Turn yourself, and here I am with you according to your desire." Then Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men and reveal ourselves to them. If they say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up. For the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us." Now Jonathan calls the Philistines the uncircumcised. "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised." Actually, several of the surrounding nations were actually circumcised. As John Gill points out, the Edomites, the Arabians did circumcision, but not the Philistines. Why did Jonathan mention this? Well, he wants to emphasize that he and his armor bearer are going up against people that don't have the Lord. The circumcision was the sign of the covenant, and these people weren't in the covenant, and so we're going to take care of that. Now notice he's not real cocky about it. He says, "Perhaps the Lord will work for us," in verse 6. He doesn't know for sure, and what he does is he lays a fleece down, basically like Gideon did. A little bit different, as I'll point out to you, but it was sort of like what Gideon did. Remember, Gideon said, "If I'm supposed to attack and beat these Midianites, let me put a fleece down on the threshing floor." And there were two fleeces he set down. One of them, if the fleece is wet, but the surrounding ground is dry, well, then that's good. Then the other fleece was, if the fleece is dry, but the surrounding ground on the threshing floor is wet, then that's a miraculous sign. That's not normal. And I know that I can go beat the Midianites. Thanks, Gideon. But now, Jonathan does a similar thing here. His fleece is, are the Philistine garrisons, are they going to send the garrison, are they going to send Philistines out to meet us, or are they just going to stay up in their fortified positions and say, come on up to us, Jonathan? That's his fleece. Well, first of all, let's ask the question, was it proper for Gideon to do this? That's just as we asked the question about Gideon, was it proper for him? Well, you really ought not to be laying down fleeces for ordinary situations. God gave you common sense, a natural mind. Also, he has other means of leading you by his spirit rather than external, obvious signs. The only time you get a sign is when the situation is not routine, and this was not a routine situation. Paul got visions when things were not routine. He had a vision when he was arrested at Jerusalem. The mob almost did him in there at the end of his third journey. He had a heavenly vision, he called it. He had a vision on the road to Damascus. So, visions are fine, but they're not routine. They're unusual. And fleeces are the same way, same thing. So, asking for a sign in difficult circumstances is not unforgivable, but when signs are used as a superstitious substitute for God's guidance, we got problems. Think about what Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, did. He asked for a sign. He's gone into Haran in Syria, trying to look for a wife for Isaac. Abraham had sent him. And when he got there, or before he got there, he says this in Genesis 24:14, "Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, 'Please let down your jar so that I may drink,'" he's praying to God, Eliezer is, "'this girl to whom I shall say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master.'" So, there's another example of somebody asking for a sign from God. Now, in the case of Eliezer, it was sort of a natural sign because a girl who offered to water camels as well as to water the owner of the camels shows that she has a good character, and that's what Eliezer is looking for. Likewise, in this situation, Jonathan is using some natural information here. If the Philistines say, wait where you are and we're coming to you, that means they're very cocky, very confident, and Jonathan is going to have to stand in his place, as he says in verse 9. He's got to go into a defensive posture. But on the other hand, if the Philistines say, and let me make my point here, and so that is a natural thing. If you see Philistines coming down, that naturally shows you that they're very confident. But if on the other hand, they stay in their fortified position and they say, Jonathan, you come up to us, that also naturally tells you that they're scared to attack and so they're not as confident. So Jonathan's fleece, if I may call it that, and Eliezer's, the servant of Abraham's fleece, they are not quite as stark as Gideon's was, because Gideon's was a total supernatural thing. He didn't get any guidance at all from the natural about from dry fleece or wet fleeces about whether he should attack the Midianites. So verse 8, Jonathan says, "Behold, we will cross over to the men, to the Philistines, and reveal ourselves to them." That's crossing over that pass there between Geba and Michmash, between the two crags, Bozez and Sina, one crag being to the north of that pass and one crag being to the south of that pass. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 14, verses 11 through 14. "They let themselves," that's Jonathan and his armor-bearer, "let themselves be seen by the Philistine garrison. And the Philistine said, 'Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they've been hiding.' The men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor-bearer, 'Come on up, and we'll teach you a lesson.' They said, 'Follow me,' Jonathan told his armor-bearer, 'for the Lord has handed them over to Israel.'" The reason he says that is because he'd laid down that fleece before, and he said, "If they stay holed up, that means we're going to go get them." And that's exactly what the men of the garrison did. They said, "Come on up. Come up to where we are." Verse 13, 1 Samuel 14. "Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet with his armor-bearer behind him." Now, what I think happened here is when Jonathan and the armor-bearer were seen, they allowed themselves to be seen by the Philistine garrison. That's when they went down in the valley between Geba and Michmash. And then when they got to the north, they had to go up across one of those crags. I don't know which one was to the north. I don't think it says Bozez and Sina, whichever was the crag there, they had to climb over that. But in order to get to that crag, they crossed through the pass, and that's when the Philistines saw them. Verse 13 says, "Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet," which means they're through the pass now. They've been seen. They've heard what the Philistines said, and so now they're climbing up one of those crags. And, of course, the Philistines would have been totally clueless about what was going on. The Philistines must have thought that crag was inaccessible, and they had just seen them down in the valley where they could see them, and all of a sudden they're unseen, and all of a sudden, whoo, they just came over the crag. How did that happen? Now, the fact that they came upon the Philistines unseen probably helps explain how Jonathan was able to kill 20 Philistines, as we read in verse 14. Had he ascended any place where he could have been seen, he would have easily been stopped, but he climbed over that crag, came upon them unawares. And also, it says there in verse 20, it was only a half-acre field, a half-acre space that the Philistines were defeated in, and that might explain how Jonathan was able to do it. A narrow defile, you can only defend one man at a time in file, and so Jonathan just picks them off, kind of like Sergeant York did. They were constrained by the geography there, and so Jonathan was able to whip up on the Philistines and kill 20 of them. Now, these 20, as Adam Clark says, were sort of an outpost or advanced guard to the garrison, kind of like sentries. But when 20 corpses will be found by the rest of the Philistines, they're going to think, "Oh my gosh, a numerous force must have knocked these 20 out. Where did this, how did this happen?" And then there's going to be panic, which we'll see in just a minute. There's going to be panic galore. Now, a few minor points before we leave these verses 11 through 14. The Philistines, when they saw Jonathan and the armor-bearer, they said, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they've been hiding." 1 Samuel 13:6 says this, "The men of Israel saw that they were in trouble because the troops were in a difficult situation. They hid in caves, thickets among rocks, and in holes and cisterns." In other words, they were in bad shape, and they were cowering, and they were scared, and the Philistines look down there, and they say, "Oh, they're coming out of their holes. Ah, they must be running out of food. They're starving. We've got this." So they say to Jonathan, "Come on up. We'll teach you a lesson." They probably were thinking that they were in good shape. They were probably pretty cocky. Now, Jameson, Foster, and Brown say that the Philistines probably didn't even think that Jonathan and his armor-bearer were coming with hostile designs. Maybe they just come into powwow to palaver a little bit because of the impossibility of the situation. Or maybe they were coming up to desert from the Israelite army. No attempt was made to hinder their ascent. Nobody tried to stone them. They just showed up. So they probably thought these two guys are deserting because two guys aren't going to attack an entrenched army. That would be stupid. And so they're cocky. They're looking at what they think are deserters. They have no idea that 20 of them are about to be killed, and those 20 corpses are going to cause a panic in the Philistine army. This has to be miraculous, folks. Miraculous. Now, verse 12 says, "Come on up and we'll teach you a lesson." That sounds like the Philistines are not really looking at Jonathan and his armor bearer as deserters, but as hostiles. The NASB doesn't translate it that way. The NASB says, the Philistines said, "Come on up and we'll tell you something." We'll tell you something. I don't know what they'd be telling them. Adam Clark says, the something is this: we will show you how well fortified we are and how able to quell all the attacks of your countrymen. So maybe they thought they were deserters. Maybe they thought they were just trying to negotiate. I don't know what they were thinking, but the Philistines were really confident, and that confidence is going to go bye-bye here very soon. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verse 15. And there was a trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. Even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling. Well, already we've got supernatural workings to get those 20 Philistines killed, and to top it all off, God causes an earthquake. That's going to be the coup de grace, because now the Philistines are in total terror. Now the Philistines are in total terror. So the trembling was in the camp in the field. That's at Michmash, where the Philistine garrison is. Among all the people, that could be referred to those attending the army, providing provisions and all, because all armies have a bucket load of people supplying them. The earth quaked. Now, I'm assuming it was a little earthquake. John Gill says that, because it sounds to me like it was a literal earthquake. Adam Clark disagrees. He says that the quaking, the trembling, was referring to the inhabitants of the earth thereabout, who quaked with terror. Well, you could say there was a trembling in the camp. Yeah, that's terror. You could do that. But at the last part of verse 15, it says, and the earth quaked. Sounds literal to me. So the quaking can either refer to the ground or to the people. I prefer to think that it referred to the people. The NIV translates this verse, then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field, and those in the outpost and raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. That by God is a textual issue there, because some manuscripts just have it was a panic. The by God's left off, as the NIV note and the Holman Christian Study Bible note. Now, what was this panic about? What was the origin of the panic? John Gill mentions four possibilities. It's the panic number one option. It's the widespread nature of the panic through the Philistine camp. I shouldn't say options. I should say, what were the contributing factors to the panic? Well, when people get panicked, the panic spreads, and so then the panic spread all through the Philistine camp, because panic is infectious. It could be the Philistines were worried. They had an apprehension of a larger Israelite force coming, in addition to Jonathan and his armor bearer. Now, this is ironic, since the Israelites only had 600 men, but the Philistines didn't know that. They thinking, oh my gosh, they've killed 20 of our men. We don't know where the Israelites came from to do this, and so maybe a bigger army is coming. So they panicked. And then, of course, watching an earthquake, that would tend to make you panic. And perhaps panic spread because of a suspicion of treachery amongst the Philistines. They might have thinking, how could all these terrible things have happened to us unless somebody has betrayed us? There's no way that two measly Israelites could cause 20 of our centuries to be killed unless somebody let them in to do that. There's treachery in the camp. I mean, after all, the Israelites, as of the day before, was good as finished. They were hiding in holes and caverns and crags and rocks. And now, panic is everywhere. And last but not least, the Israelites started attacking each other in their panic. 1 Samuel 14:20. Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was great confusion. Saul, we'll see here in just a minute, he joins the battle after Jonathan does his feat. And then, at that point, the Philistines started attacking Philistines. Every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. That happens a lot. You read the history of battles. Armies get confused, and they start attacking each other in the confusion when they are attacked, especially at night, and they're sleeping, and the enemy comes up, and they're not ready for them, and they end up killing themselves. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verses 16 and 17. When Saul's watchmen in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, they saw the panicking troops scattering in every direction. So Saul said to the troops with him, call the roll and determine who has left us. They called the roll and saw that Jonathan and his armor-bearer were gone. Now Saul had watchmen in Gibeah. He's up there right outside of Michmash in Migron. Gibeah is about 4 or 5 miles to the southwest of Geba, where Jonathan launched his two-man attack. And so Saul, and Gibeah is on a hill, so Saul's men could look across and see what's going on. So they looked, and they saw, fleeing from Michmash, panicking troops scattering in every direction. And of course, then Saul's watchman must have sent a message on up to Migron, wherever that is, maybe 4 or 5 miles away, and they said, hey, the Philistines are running, and so then Saul says, we've got to figure out what's caused this. He figures it has to be somebody. The Philistines are not going to just leave on their own. Verse 17, so Saul said to the troops with him, remember he's at Migron, we know that from verse 2 of chapter 14 here, Saul was staying under the pomegranate tree in Migron on the outskirts of Gibeah. Now notice in verse 16, the Philistine troops scattered in every direction. The NASB has they melted. That means there was no order as the Philistines dispersed. It was not an orderly retreat. It was a rout. Verse 17, Saul calls the roll to see who had left. He figured that someone from his camp had caused the rout. He could see what was going on as well as his watchman saying, hey, the troops are scattering in every direction. He must have wondered, Saul did, must have wondered who in the world would have attacked without telling him, Saul. Well, again, that may be, or it could be he gave a previous command to Jonathan, attack when you're ready. At any rate, he called the roll looking for who would attack the Philistines, and that wouldn't take long. They just had 600 men, if you recall. So we read now in 1 Samuel 14, 18 through 19. Then Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. That's Migron. Bring the ark of God here. For the ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. While Saul talked to the priest, the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued and increased. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. Remember Ahijah, he's a descendant of Phinehas, Eli's son. We've already talked about him. He's the high priest that's wearing the ephod there that we talked about. Saul says, bring the ark of God here. Now, we have a split of opinion on what this was brought to Saul. Was it the ark or was it the ephod? Here's what John Gill says. He said the ark was brought, but something more than the ark was brought. The, quote, the high priest might put on the ephod with the Urim and Thummim and inquire by them of the Lord before it. Concerning the affair of Jonathan, what he had done and the agitation that was in the host of the Philistines. So the Septuagint version says, bring the ephod. So Gil, I'm not sure whether Gil says the ephod alone was brought or the ephod was brought with the ark. Jameson Foster Brown says, no, it wasn't the ark that was brought to Saul at all. It was the ephod. Here's what they say, quote, there's no evidence that the ark had been brought from Kiriath Jearim. The Septuagint version is preferable, which by slight variation of the text reads the ephod. That is the priestly cape which the high priest put on when consulting the oracle, the Urim and Thummim. That this should be at hand is natural from the presence of Ahijah himself, as well as the nearness of Nob, where the tabernacle was then situated. Now, here's some translations that say it was the ephod rather than the ark. Bring the ephod of God here so I can inquire. That makes sense to me. Why would you need the ark? You need the ephod so you can get to the Urim and Thummim. The Bible in Basic English and the New American Bible actually translates it as ephod rather than ark, using the Septuagint as its textual source there. So I'm going to assume it was the ephod that Saul is asking for. He wants some direction. Should we go after the Philistines or not? Now, a little side note here. The tabernacle was at Nob, according to Jameson, Foster, and Brown. If Nob is right northeast of the Mount of Olives, and if you go northwest from Nob, you end up in the general area of where we are now, just a few miles, so it was nearby. Now, how the tabernacle got from Shiloh to Nob, I don't know. I'm just taking Jameson, Foster, and Brown's word for it here. Maybe with further study, I will know how it got there. I don't know. So, if that's true, we got the tabernacle at Nob, the ark at Kiriath Jearim, and the ephod here at Migron, split out all over the place. Notice that Saul didn't start inquiring of the Lord till things got going good. He says, whoa, there's some commotion in the camp. Whoa, maybe there's panic. Let's inquire from the ark of God. It seems to me he would have just gone ahead and gone, but what he did was he got the priest halfway inquiring of the Urim and Thummim, and then Saul says, withdraw your hand. In other words, stop what you're doing. We're going to attack the Philistines now. We don't have time. We don't need to listen anymore what the will of God is. We're going. Because Saul heard the commotion, the shrieks and the cries of those being trampled and wounded, and he says, let's go. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates that literal phrase there when Saul said to Ahijah, withdraw your hand. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates that as stop what you're doing. In other words, quit inquiring of the Urim and Thummim. It could be that Saul is saying, hey, Ahijah, quit putting on the ephod. Or, hey, quit inquiring of the Urim and Thummim. Or, hey, quit putting the ark in a proper position. Or, hey, Ahijah, quit lifting up your hands in prayer. Well, who knows? Basically, he's saying, no more inquiry. We're going to attack. Saul figured there was no need to consult the Lord now. There's no time to be lost. The route was on. The enemy needed to be pursued. The rabbis look at this as one of Saul's sins that kept his kingdom from being prolonged, and John Gill agrees with that. Well, I don't know about that. If he was so godless to start with, why did he ask the ark or the ephod to be brought up to Migron in the first place, unless he trusted in Yahweh? Maybe he was legitimately in a hurry. This is what Adam Clark says. Before he had made an end of consulting him, Ahijah, the increasing noise of the panic-struck Philistines called his attention, and finding there was no time to lose, he immediately collected his men and fell on them. Well, okay, what's wrong with that? Jameson, Foss, and Brown say this. The priest, invested with the ephod, that's Ahijah, prayed with raised and extended hands. Saul, perceiving that the opportunity was inviting and that God appeared to have sufficiently declared in favor of his people, requested the priest to cease, that they might immediately join in the contest. The season for consultation was past. The time for prompt action was come. So those two commentators don't really have any opprobrium to place on Saul's head for what he did, and I don't either. I don't see anything wrong with it. I think the rabbis and Gill are a little bit wrong about that. I mean, if you want to look for Saul's defects, there's plenty of them. We don't have to manufacture them. We go now to verse 20, 1 Samuel 14. Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. All the people who were with Saul, that would be the 600 who were with Saul, could be, again, it's a speculation, the 1,000 of the garrison that had been set up there in chapter 13 from Gilgal, that had been with Jonathan at Gibeah, who had then moved up to Geba, and they could have kept on going and been right here and joined with Saul's 600, so for a total of 1,600, but I don't think so. I think the garrisons had probably melted away and were hiding in the holes in the caves and the rocks. Now, notice that the Philistines had every man's sword being wielded against his fellow, the Philistine sword. Remember, the Israelites didn't have swords. They didn't have spears either. And it's ironic that they didn't need them. The Philistines did the job for them. Again, that shows that God supernaturally supplies his people with what they need when they need it. How do we know that the Israelites didn't have swords and spears? In the last chapter, 1 Samuel 13:22. So on the day of battle, not a sword or spear could be found in the hand of any of the troops who were with Saul and Jonathan. Only Saul and his son Jonathan had weapons. Now, how did the Philistines get confused so that they were attacking each other and hacking each other with their swords? Well, they could have taken each other for attacking Israelites, which again makes you think this is at nighttime. That's usually when this happens at night. Or it could be they took each other for traitors that had let the Israelites get in to such a protected place as Michmash was. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verse 21. Now the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, who went up with them all around in the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. So there were some Hebrews who used to be with the Philistines and came back to their countrymen. Who were these people? Adam Clark suggests they were servants and slaves of the Philistines. They had been brought along to serve the Philistines in the camp. So that would mean the Philistines were making slaves out of the Hebrews. Could be there were residents in Jewish cities previously occupied by the Philistines and who had been forced into the Philistine army, drafted into the army. Could be there were deserters from the Israelite army, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. But whoever they were, wherever they came from, they're deserting the Philistines, going back to their roots. We go now to 1 Samuel 14, verses 22 and 23, and we will finish this section. When all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim, those are the ones that hid themselves in the holes and the caves and the crags and the rocks, when they heard that the Philistines had fled, even they also pursued them closely in the battle. So, I mean, the Israelites are all coming together now. Verse 23, so the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth-Aven. Verse 22, and it says, all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country, that's a direct reference to 1 Samuel 13:6. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and in pits. They weren't hiding anymore. The battle is then spread to Beth-Aven. I've got a map here. Migron and Michmash, right north of the valley that runs between Michmash and Geba on the south, where Jonathan attacked from. Then you go about another 3 miles or so up the road. You end up at Ai, and Beth-Aven is northeast of Ai. Question mark. They don't know exactly where it is, so we'll say it's about 3 miles to the north, I guess. But the point is that the Philistines are fleeing north, and the Israelites are chasing them through the hill country. So the Lord delivered Israel that day. And it's ironic, Saul had just finished disrespecting God and Samuel at Gilgal. That's in the last chapter. Remember when Saul didn't wait for Samuel like Samuel and God had told Saul to wait? And he started taking on some priestly duties for himself, which might have been that got Samuel upset with him and God upset with him. Or it might have been the fact that he didn't wait, but for whatever reason he had disrespected God. God let him win anyway. John Gill says the victory was, quote, a free favor bestowed on an undeserving prince. Well, on this happy note of victory, we will leave Saul and Jonathan. And now we are prepared to turn to 1 Samuel 14, verses 24 through 52, the end of the chapter. And we will look at Saul's rash vow concerning honey. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.